Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Incorporating Antipsychotics into Regimens for Treatment-Resistant Depression, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Thomas L. Schwartz, MD. Dr. Schwartz is an associate professor, Department of Psychiatry, SUNY Upstate Medical University, Director, Adult Outpatient Services, Director, Treatment-Resistant Depression and Anxiety Disorders Program, SUNY Upstate University Hospital, Syracuse, New York. Dr. Schwartz has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor to PAMLAB and Day. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Merck & Company. He received grants for clinical research from Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Cephalon, and Cyberonix. Dr. Schwartz does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Schwartz does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to describe the role of atypical antipsychotics in the treatment of refractory major depressive disorder. This activity is supported by Otsuka America Pharmaceutical. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
So welcome to this Medscape education event. My name is Tom Schwartz. I'm from SUNY Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. We've been discussing treating major depressive disorder, and the title of this talk is Incorporating Antipsychotics into Regimens for Treatment-Resistant Depression. Our learning objectives for today revolves around developing antidepressant regimens that take into account individual patient characteristics. And specifically, we want to identify patients for whom augmentation with a second-generation antipsychotic is appropriate, as well as those in whom it is not. Now, we've spoken before about the STAR-D federally funded trial. And if you remember, when we discussed that, we noted that two-thirds of our patients do not get into full depressive remission with their first SSRI antidepressant, and that's certainly depicted here. We also discussed in this trial that we tried successive antidepressant monotherapies, augmentation strategies, combination strategies, and really in successive trials, maybe 12 weeks each, and the goal was to keep aiming for remission. One thing I wanted to make clear is the atypical antipsychotics, the second generation antipsychotics, were not included in this study. I'm often asked at lectures, where would the atypical antipsychotics fit if they were included? Now, ideally, they're not going to be used as a frontline antidepressant. They're not necessarily FDA approved for that most of the time. So we're still going to start with the SSRIs, the SNRIs, or whatever your favorite antidepressant is. If your patient fails to remit, you really could, per the FDA, per indications, utilize some of the second-generation antipsychotics as your second treatment. Now, in the STAR-D trial, the second treatments were more often other antidepressants. And the idea is the second phase of STAR-D used drugs that were relatively safe, really did not have end organ damage or serious side effects to consider. Now, the atypical antipsychotics certainly can convey movement disorders, metabolic disorders, they likely would be positioned at level 3 in STAR-D. So perhaps to follow this regimen or this algorithm, starting with one antidepressant, switching to a second antidepressant, at that point the risks of not gaining remission increase. So the likelihood that you would need to use an atypical antipsychotic, which has slightly increased side effect burden, makes more sense. So I always tell clinicians that using an atypical antipsychotic falls somewhere between level 2 and level 3 if we were to go back and rerun STAR-D, in fact, using the atypical antipsychotics. Now, going back to treatment guidelines, if your monotherapy fails to improve your patient to get them to remission, if we specifically look at augmentation, the first box is the second generation antipsychotics. Clearly, we have FDA approvals and indications to use them. There are many double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trials. Many of these have 300 to 400 patients. So the evidence base certainly supports using a second-generation antipsychotic. However, there are certainly other options. Lithium, for example, has several double-blind trials as well. Not as many patients were enrolled, but these are very well done and stringent trials. Lithium is considered one of the classic augmentation strategies. Thyroid hormone as well has a few trials that can be used as an evidence base to support augmentation with thyroid hormone. Nutraceuticals, vitamin-based therapies, complementary alternative medicine therapies, these are called many different things. But we're starting to see smaller randomized trials with products such as L-methylfolate and SAMe. And we could go on. There are certainly a lot of other strategies that have anywhere from no evidence base to at least a minimal evidence base to support their use. So you certainly have choices, and you want to learn to tailor your augmentation strategies based on your patient's residual symptoms, ability to tolerate side effects, and which drugs may be riskier than others in regards to providing a prescription. So beyond monotherapy, so guidelines for major depressive disorder treatment can offer a range of options, from psychotherapy to multiple classes of pharmacotherapy, and certainly device-based treatments for our more resistant patients. This activity is going to look specifically at where antipsychotics fit into treatment-resistant depression and how and when they can be considered. So moving on that, let's talk about FDA approvals. In regards to monotherapy, quetiapine and quetiapine XR are clearly FDA approved for treating bipolar depression as a monotherapy. Now, adjunctive treatments, we certainly have more options. Aripiprazole is approved for augmentation strategy for resistant major depression. Quetiapine XR is also approved for augmentation. And again, by treatment-resistant depression, this is usually somebody who's failed at least one monotherapy antidepressant. Now, in the trials for both of these drugs, most patients had actually failed one, two, or three previous antidepressants. Finally, we have some combination strategies that really do involve using antipsychotic agents. The first one is actually the original use of an antipsychotic, a first-generation antipsychotic. Profenazine combined with amitriptyline is approved for major depressive disorder. In a more modern second-generation antipsychotic combination, olanzapine-fluoxetine combination also is specifically worded and approved for treatment-resistant depression. Now, do the second-generation antipsychotics work? The answer is yes. We shared with you those FDA approvals. But even some of the other atypical antipsychotics have off-label data supporting their use in treating depression. This is a meta-analysis by George Papakostas out of the Mass General System, and it isn't just the approved atypical antipsychotics. Others were involved, and clearly in this analytic process separate from placebo, suggesting they have antidepressant effects, albeit off-label for some of the atypical antipsychotics. So why might the second-generation antipsychotics make good antidepressants? So without getting bogged down into biochemistry and pharmacodynamic properties, let me name a few. All atypical antipsychotics share serotonin 2 receptor blockade. The net effect of this is often to promote norepinephrine and dopamine towards the frontal cortex. Now, this is a good thing. Our frontal cortex, when depressed, are typically underfunctioning or hypofunctioning. Stimulating that with norepinephrine and dopamine may be considered a good thing. All atypicals share this property to one degree or another. The same antagonism can actually promote deeper sleep and more condensed sleep. Many of our depressed patients have alterations in their ability to fall asleep and stay asleep. Some of the atypical antipsychotics contain norepinephrine reuptake inhibition properties. Again, many of our antidepressants, half of the property of the SNRI class, half of our tricyclics promote norepinephrine this way. One of the atypical antipsychotics is a SSRI, essentially, promotes serotonin through that mechanism. A few of the second-generation drugs actually are serotonin and 1A receptor agonists. That's how the product for generalized anxiety, buspirone, works. So many of these drugs may provide some anxiolysis, and oftentimes off-label we use that property as an augmentation strategy. Interestingly, the latest FDA-approved antidepressant, vilazodone, uses this serotonin 1A property as well. Many of them block serotonin 7 receptors, which improves our circadian clock and functioning. And finally, blocking the histamine 1 receptor. It's an antihistamine. People might get sedated as a side effect, but they might actually sleep better. And products like hydroxyzine are used for treating anxiety. And so antihistamine properties may promote better sleep and actually anxiolytic properties. So it gets messy, but many of the atypicals have their own unique thumbprint as to which one of these receptors and properties they manipulate. Many of these can lend to antidepressant properties, even if there's not clear FDA approval or evidence-based randomized controlled trials. So we've talked about the good of the second generation antipsychotics and how they might work and where they work for depression. What about the negatives? All drugs have side effects. So for example, clear problems or difficulties with the antipsychotics include weight gain, high blood pressure, cholesterol and lipid problems. Now again, to be fair, some of our antidepressants will do this as well. But in the modern era of the second generation antipsychotics, they do carry the most warnings in regards to FDA literature. The other thing, if you decide to prescribe an atypical antipsychotic, you now enter the world of movement disorders, extrapyramidal symptoms, tardive dyskinesia. These are real. We all know the first generation drugs are particularly effective in a bad way at causing movement disorders, but the atypicals still block dopamine 2 receptors. Patients still have to be monitored and frankly told about the risk for EPS and TD problems. Some of the atypical antipsychotics carry cardiac warnings regarding QTC prolongation. Initially, this was afforded to ziprasidone and iloperidone, and more recently, quetiapine also carries a warning for increasing QTC prolongation. Again, patients with cardiac conditions or where this may prove to be problematic or even fatal, these particular agents should be avoided. The atypical antipsychotics carry a risk for stroke in patients with dementia and agitation. These are basically based on findings regarding risperidone and aripiprazole, but it's a class warning for every atypical agent. Also, as these drugs have become bona fide FDA-approved antidepressants, many now carry warnings regarding lethality and suicidality when they're used in patients 24 years and younger. Again, this type of warning, this type of risk must be considered before prescribing. And again, making people tired, dizzy, and groggy. This is common with many of our drugs that we use in psychiatry, but certainly in the world of the atypical antipsychotics, some are worse at this type of side effect profile than others. And again, choosing an atypical antipsychotic should be based on FDA approval, evidence base, and frankly, what side effects do you want to try to avoid or lessen when you're choosing one out of this class? So, which depressive patients are candidates for a second-generation antipsychotic product when they're augmented for depression? So, according to the FDA and regulatory guidelines, anybody failing to remit after a single SSRI or SNRI antidepressant really could be on label and prescribed a second-generation antipsychotic. Again, the data's there. We've reviewed that. We've reviewed the rationale pharmacodynamically. You could very aggressively start as the second drug in. Again, we discussed where this might fit in STAR-D. There certainly is an increased side effect burden with using an atypical antipsychotic over switching to another monotherapy with an SSRI or an SNRI. Now, there are some ideal places where the atypical antipsychotic should be used. What if the depression is psychotic with guilt-based delusions? Clearly, an atypical would be warranted very quickly and very aggressively. Patients with bipolar depression. A majority of the atypical antipsychotics are approved for preventing and stopping mania, and only a couple of them are approved for bipolar depression. The nice thing with the second generation drugs is that they have the ability to stop elevated mood and sometimes the ability to stop depression, all in a monotherapy. I particularly in my practice like using the atypical antipsychotics when my depressed patient is particularly agitated, anxious, has insomnia, is irritable or aggressive. I really think those pharmacodynamic properties work well on that profile of a patient. And finally, patients with cluster B personality traits or disorder. There are no FDA approvals for this type of depression or this type of disorder, but the evidence base would hint that the atypical antipsychotics actually seem to have an edge over SSRI or SNRI monotherapies. So I may more quickly go to a second generation drug in patients with these kind of traits or symptoms. Now, who would be a bad candidate or a more difficult candidate to augment with an atypical antipsychotic? Certainly anybody with a pre-existing movement disorder, so patients perhaps with Parkinson's disease, where we're only going to complicate their Parkinson's disease. or if they have other tremor-based disorders, or maybe they have multiple sclerosis or a brain injury that is giving them movement problems, I would typically avoid an antipsychotic at all possible costs in this type of patient. What about patients with pre-existing metabolic disorder, patients who are overweight, have blood pressure, have lipid problems already? I would try to avoid the atypical antipsychotic class. However, in that class, certain atypicals have more risk for creating metabolic problems and other ones have less. If you had to choose an atypical antipsychotic in this case, ideally you would choose one that's not well known for creating or worsening metabolic syndrome. Now, what about patients that have problems with ataxia, gait disturbance, psychomotor impairment? They're prone to falling. Again, some of our atypical antipsychotics are more sedating than others. Again, ideally avoiding a sedating one makes sense in patients that have these ongoing issues. Now, dosing. Let me make a couple of quick comments. The second generation antipsychotics, if you want to treat mania, if you want to treat schizophrenia psychosis, we typically need to use higher doses. At the higher doses, the dopamine 2 receptor blockade becomes adequate and aggressive enough to stop those symptoms. However, when you're treating major depressive disorder, the lower end of dose range is typically what we use. At the lower doses, we do make good availability for the serotonin 2 blockade that we mentioned and some of the other pharmacodynamic properties as well. They really kick in at the lower doses, and typically we don't require huge doses that we would use in schizophrenia or bipolar mania patients. So for example, aripiprazole is approved for depression augmentation. It's typically dosed from 2 to 15 milligrams. The average dose in studies is 10 to 11 milligrams. If we were treating mania or schizophrenia, we might use upwards of 30. So again, we're using a very low dose to try to treat depression. Quetiapine XR, also FDA approved in this area, dosing for depression is 150 to 300 milligrams per day. However, if we were treating mania or psychosis, we might use 400 to 800. And if you go off-label and use other atypical antipsychotics, then again, my argument would be to stick to lower doses instead of higher doses. Now, what about monitoring? We've talked about the good effects and the side effects of these drugs. Certainly, if you're treating somebody with depression, monitoring for lethality makes sense, especially if they're a younger adult. All of these drugs can convey risk for tardive dyskinesia, extrapyramidal symptoms. Guidelines would suggest that at every visit, you monitor for these. And there are different in-office testing regimens you can go through in order to determine if somebody is in an early stage of extrapyramidal symptoms or tardive dyskinesia. I think the key is to inform your patient that some of these things may happen and then routinely following it. If you're using these drugs in a patient that's at risk for stroke or has had stroke or is a demented psychotic patient, again, patients need to be warned of this. And again, monitoring for blood pressure and other neurological signs makes sense. Metabolics we already discussed. The risks do vary depending which second generation antipsychotic you choose. The ADA would recommend checking things like BMI, waist circumference, blood pressures, running blood work basically on occasion to make sure your patient hasn't become pre-diabetic or started a cholesterol problems. Typically you'll see triglycerides go up first in this blood work. At that point, you as the clinician has to decide, should we switch medications, should we refer for help managing the metabolic issues, or should you start treating the metabolic issues? But I think monitoring is the key after good informed consent. We've talked about the atypical antipsychotics. Some might cause you to be more or less sedated. For some people, sedation is good. It affords better sleep and anxiolysis. For other people, it's a clear side effect. That should be monitored. One of the atypical antipsychotics, quetiapine, carries a risk for cataracts, and it's suggested that every 6 months that product line, patients on that product be reviewed for eye problems and cataract problems. Overall, many of our patients, especially those with schizophrenia, are likely more prone to cataracts as well. So vision is appropriate to follow. And we did discuss the drugs that have QTC prolongation. It's not typically needed to get EKGs on every patient on an atypical antipsychotic. But if you are to use one of these that is prone to QTC prolongation and they have cardiac issues, it would make sense to pre-monitor with an EKG and then certainly do follow-up ones after steady state dosing is achieved. So in summary, we talked about the second generation antipsychotics. We talked clearly about the ones that are FDA approved. Many of the ones, even the non-approved ones, have antidepressant pharmacodynamic properties that could be utilized in your practice. The data and guidelines clearly support the effectiveness of the second-generation antipsychotics in treating unipolar depression. However, we always have to remember there are safety concerns. Once you start using an atypical antipsychotic, they do carry some risks that typically aren't associated as greatly with some of the monotherapy antidepressants. So I do think good informed consent, good monitoring, good follow-up is needed if you decide to prescribe. The clear concerns with the atypical antipsychotics involve movement disorders and metabolic disorders. And again, I think good informed consent and good monitoring makes good practice. So in the end, thank you for listening to this Medscape Education Initiative. Thank you for participating in the activity.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Incorporating Antipsychotics into Regimens for Treatment-Resistant Depression. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.